In order to justify paying for such costly feathers, some needed to believe that the fish could distinguish between the 20 shades of green described in the masterworks on fly tying. Kelson admitted in his book that the classification for selecting which salmon flies to cast was artificial, but he couldn't seem to accept the full implications, indignantly recounting the time when a salmon ignored his flies for a simple fly tied by an amateur angler. "At times, salmon will take anything. At times, nothing. In a fever of excitement, the king of fish will exercise his royal jaw upon a thing it were an outrage to call a salmon fly. A one-sided, wobbling, hydrocephalic bunch of incongruous feathers." But before long, he was back to preaching about the principles of symmetry and the harmony of balanced colors in a fly. For Kelson, fly tying had a kinship with the fine arts. He claimed the practice would instill a mental and moral discipline in his disciples. "We have here a well-bred hobby, noteworthy of the attention of the greatest amongst us who are fishers, whether divines or statesmen, doctors or lawyers, poets, painters or philosophers." For such great men, Kelson's Bible included 8 stunning hand-colored plates depicting 52 finished flies with lofty names like the Champion, the Infallible, Thunder and Lightning, the Bronze Pirate, and Traherne's Wonder. The salmon fly included detailed recipes for some 300 flies, laying out which materials were required for each part. The eye of the fly was to be fashioned out of a loop of silkworm gut. The head, horns, cheeks, sides, throat, underwing, and overwing all required special plumes. His analytical diagram of the fly reveals 19 different components, to say nothing of the various styles and curvatures of hook. To tie like Kelson, his readers would need a silver monkey, a gray squirrel, pig's wool, silk from the Orient, fur from the Arctic, a hare's face, and a goat's beard. There were single tapered shanks and double tapered shanks, single-eyed and double-eyed hooks, flat tinsel, oval tinsel, embossed tinsel, and tinseled chenilles. Seal's fur in bright orange, lemon, fiery brown, scarlet, claret, purple, green, golden olive, dark and light blue, and black. Cobbler's wax. The list of materials needed in order to tie Victorian salmon flies was long, even before any mention of feathers. Kelson rattled through his current inventory of bird skins. The banded chatterer, now endangered, the great American cock, the Nankeen night heron, the South American bittern, and the Ecuadorian cock of the rock. But there was one skin that Kelson prized above all. "The greatest find that has fallen to my lot is the golden bird of paradise. May this luck be your luck, brother fisherman, as it has been mine. It will only cost you 10 pounds. He acknowledged that the dyed feathers of common birds could be used when exotic ones were out of reach, but stressed that however well hackles may be dyed, they never look so well, even when fresh, or are so effective in the water as natural ones. Take, for instance, the hackles of a golden bird of paradise. The best dyed orange hackle in creation would simply be nowhere in competition with it." Kelson and his book were so influential that even before he died in 1920, he'd become a brand name. Burberry's offered a waterproof Kelson jacket, featuring large pockets for fly boxes and special flies. C. Farlow and Company created a custom Kelson rod and the Kelson patent silent aluminum salmon winch. Morris Carswell and Company sold Kelson enameled salmon fishing line. Kelson knew he had his detractors, fishermen who were skeptical of the need for such prismatic creations, but he brushed them off as narrow-minded enthusiasts piteously hoodwinked on an exceptional day by getting a fish or two with the wrong fly presented the wrong way. Galileo had been similarly doubted in his time, he noted. Over the course of the 20th century, scattered pockets of fly tiers followed the recipes of Kelson and his peers, but fly tying didn't truly reemerge until the final decades, thanks in part to the influence of Paul Schmuckler. In 1990, a Sports Illustrated profile of his salmon flies, which were being snatched up by collectors for $2,000 apiece, began with this. If Donald Trump continues having trouble making interest payments on the Taj Mahal, maybe he should call up Paul Schmuckler, one of his old schoolmates from New York Military Academy, for some money-making tips. To dress one fly, marveled the author, Schmuckler will use up to 150 different materials, ranging from polar bear and mink fur to the feathers of wild turkeys, golden and Reeves pheasants, the African speckled bustard, and the Brazilian blue chatterer. The materials I use are not from animals on the endangered species list, or were collected before the Endangered Species Act was passed, said Schmuckler. When you tie artistic or classic style Atlantic salmon flies, you not only have to know materials, but you have to know the law. Throughout the 1990s, Schmuckler published a number of coffee table books with titles like Rare and Unusual Fly Tying Materials, A Natural History, and Forgotten Flies, which sold for hundreds of dollars, with special edition leather-bound books with limited print runs going for over $1,500. His books appeared at the dawn of the internet age. Before long, eBay and Victorian fly tying forums would usher in a new wave of feather addicts, hoping to tie just like Schmuckler, Kelson, and Blacker. Unlike their forebears, most of the new generation of tiers didn't even know how to fish. Salmon flies were instead treated as pieces of art. But as far as materials were concerned, the new tiers were marooned in the wrong century. There were no more stevedores in London and New York unloading shipments of bird-of-paradise skins. The tackle shops advertised in Kelson's books were long gone. Feather-filled hats had been out of fashion for more than 100 years. Many of the birds required in Kelson's recipes were endangered, threatened, or protected by the CITES Convention against trafficking. The new tires were dedicated to an art form that could no longer be legally practiced without great difficulty. The arrival of the internet triggered a brief flood of rare birds as enterprising eBay users rummaged through their grandmother's attics and uncovered Victorian hats to sell. There were online auctions of 19th-century cabinets filled with curios of the natural world, including the occasional exotic bird. Offline, some wealthy tyers had luck at estate sales in the British countryside. One resourceful fly tyer made off with a number of stuffed birds that he rented from a company specializing in movie props. But there were only so many attics to explore, only so many feathers that could be plucked from 150-year-old hats. The price of a pair of feathers from the blue chatterer, Indian crow, resplendent quetzal, or bird of paradise, some of which were protected species, climbed as the practice grew in popularity. The lucky few who happened to have rare bird skins were on top, idolized by the pining mass of featherless newcomers below. By virtue of owning such exotic materials, they alone could tie the most beautiful flies. The only way most fly tiers could see such birds was to ogle at them behind the display cases at natural history museums, like the one at Tring. Chapter 6. The Future of Fly Tying. In 1705, just outside the Hudson Valley burg of Claverick, 120 miles north of New York City, a 5-pound mastodon tooth, disinterred by the spring floods, rolled down a steep hill and landed at the foot of a Dutch tenant farmer working the fields. The farmer brought the fist-sized tooth into town and traded it to a local politician for a glass of rum. The first remnant of an extinct animal discovered in America, nicknamed Incognitum, set off a frenzy of theological concerns. How could something vanish from God's earth? Had Noah forgotten to load Incognitum onto the ark? By 1998, when the Rist family decamped from the Upper West Side of Manhattan to Claverick, another 100 species, 70 of them birds, had disappeared, hunted into extinction. Many other things had vanished from the small town over the years. The town's grist and sawmills, powered for a century by the 150-foot waterfall of the Claverick Creek, had shuttered. Gone, too, were the cotton and wool factories. A few thousand brown trout stocked into the creek each year by the Columbia County Fishery fan in its pools and riffles, eyeing flies and dodging anglers. 10 years old when the family moved north, Edwin was no field and stream child. The mere sight of red ants sent him bolting for higher ground. He spent most of his time indoors, doing his homework, practicing the flute, and playing with his younger brother, Anton. The boys were homeschooled by their parents, Lynn and Curtis, who were both Ivy League graduates and freelance writers. Lynn taught them history, while Curtis covered mathematics. By day, Curtis wrote pieces for Discover magazine on an eclectic range of topics, from the physics of the basketball foul shot to the molecular chemistry of fine art conservation and the planetary movement of Neptune. By night, he read his sons the Iliad. The television was rarely on. Instilled with a love of learning, Edwin leapfrogged through his lessons, devouring new subjects. On Mondays, his mom would deposit him at the nearby adult education Spanish class, where he practiced conjugations with 40-year-olds. When Edwin developed a fascination with snakes, his parents enlisted David Dickey, a herpetologist at the American Museum of Natural History, as a biology tutor. During a family vacation to Santa Barbara, they visited the Sea Center, where a naturalist introduced the boys to camouflaged decorator crabs and a bright orange sea slug known as the Spanish Dancer. "Now that is what I want to be for Halloween," marveled Edwin. His parents nurtured whatever new interests he formed. So when Edwin's first grade music instructor told them that their son demonstrated an innate talent on the recorder, they signed him up for private lessons. He swiftly graduated to the flute, practicing with such devotion that Anton soon followed suit, taking up the clarinet. The brothers, lovingly competitive, spurred each other to new heights of achievement. Edwin took first place in the Yule Wade Music Scholarship Competition and enrolled in the international masterclass of Gene Baxtresser, the principal flautist for the New York Philharmonic. Even at a young age, perhaps as a result of the unstructured nature of homeschooling, Edwin understood that his potential in the flute would be limited only by his ability to focus. Anyone could learn scales or arpeggios. True mastery would require conquering techniques like multiphonics and flutter tonguing. But one day, late in the summer of 1999, Edwin wandered into the living room and became transfixed by what he saw on the television screen. His obsession began as a hobby, but quickly grew so feverish that the 11-year-old would soon be able to focus on little else. As research for a piece on the physics of fly fishing, Curtis had picked up a video called The Orvis Fly Fishing School. In a segment on the rudiments of tying a trout fly, the Orvis host demonstrated each step on a thumbnail-size hook clamped between the jaws of a tabletop vise. Halfway into the process, he held up an ordinary hackle feather, harvested from the neck of a rooster. Like all feathers, hackles have tiny barbs that branch out from the feather's shaft, which is known as a rachis. But when he wound the feather around the body of the fly in a helix-like wrap, a technique known as palmering, the barbs splayed out in every direction like hundreds of tiny antennae. A palmered rooster feather helps the fly float atop the river's surface. To the hungry fish below, the barbs resemble wriggling insect legs. Edwin was so captivated that he grabbed the remote and rewound the VHS, watching the sequence over and over, spellbound by the transfiguration of this simple feather. To tie a basic trout fly, the instructor employed a number of implements that looked as though they had spilled out of a Victorian surgeon's bag. There were spools of fine thread clamped between the two prongs of a stethoscope-looking tool called a bobbin. To make precise mid-course adjustments to the fibers of the feather, there was a needle-shaped device known as a bodkin. To grab hold of the narrow shaft of a feather, he used a tiny pair of hackle pliers. In the final stage of the tutorial, the instructor twisted the thread into a tight knot with a quick flourish using a whip finisher, an elegant device that resembled a deconstructed paperclip. Edwin had a habit of diving into things, so he raced down to the basement in search of materials. After uncovering a few hooks, he rummaged through drawers for thread, but the closest thing he found was a fistful of pipe cleaners. Not surprisingly, there wasn't any rooster hackle lying around, so he pulled a couple of feathers from his mom's down pillows and hurried back to his room to tie his first fly. Over the coming weeks, he tied flies with Mardi Gras beads and aluminum foil, winding whatever was at hand before untying them and starting over. But nothing came close to resembling what he saw in the video. Knowing his son was chafing for proper materials, Curtis drove him to Don's Tackle Service, a fly fishing shop a half hour away in Red Hook. Don Travers, a gruff septuagenarian, wasn't thrilled to see an 11-year-old in his store, which was lined with trays filled with carefully organized flies. But the well-behaved boy quickly won him over, returning to the register with all the tools he'd need to get started. Bags of hackle feathers, hooks, thread, bobbins, and a fly-tying vise. Like most households at that time, the Wrists didn't have internet at home, so Edwin relied on the Orvis video and a subscription to Fly Tire magazine to learn the basic techniques. His brother, Anton, became interested, and the two were soon begging for proper instruction. In 2000, the boys began taking regular fly-tying classes at Don's, where they met other tires and discovered new feathers and techniques. The materials required for trout flies weren't particularly costly. A pinch of elk hair, a couple of inches of thread and tinsel, and an ordinary hackle feather tied to a basic hook amounted to about 20 cents. Their first instructor was a 75-year-old Princeton-educated evolutionary biology professor named George Hooper, an expert on insect life and an avid fly fisherman. He approached tying like a biologist, using head-mounted dissection magnifiers and microscopes, referring to fish by their Latin binomial names, and selecting from among what seemed to Edwin like 10,000 colors of wool to fill out the bodies of his flies. Under Hooper's tutelage, Edwin tied piles of flies that he had no idea how to cast. He didn't even own a fly rod. He just liked the challenge of replicating what he saw in the Orvis video and in his magazines. Impressed with their budding talent, Hooper urged Edwin and Anton to enter fly-tying competitions, which took place at conventions throughout the country as well as Europe, where hookmakers, specialized booksellers, feather peddlers, pelt hawkers, and the stars of the show, tires, met to sell their wares and show off their talents. The competitions had a straightforward format. Entrants must tie a particular fly pattern three times in a row in front of a panel of judges who graded for quality and consistency. Always willing to encourage their son's passions, Curtis and Lynn loaded the eager boys and their gear into the car, driving to shows like the Arts of the Angler Convention in Danbury, Connecticut, where Edwin tied an astonishing 68 trout flies in an hour to take the title. At the Northeast Fly Tying Championship in Wilmington, Massachusetts, Anton was assigned the Helgramite fly, which mimicked the look of an underwater centipede-like insect known in the Ozarks as a devil scratcher. He tried his best to replicate the hideous fly, but was frustrated with each attempt. The boys were perfectionists at the vise and fixated on the slightest inconsistency or inaccuracy. It was at that moment, awaiting the judge's verdict, when Edwin saw the glimmering thing that would take a hobby and distort it into an obsession. As the brothers wandered the aisles of fly tires and feather dealers, Edwin's eyes came to rest on a huge display of 60 Victorian salmon flies, all painstakingly tied according to the 19th century recipes found in George Kelson's The Salmon Fly. Edwin had never seen anything like these spectral bursts of iridescent turquoise, emerald, crimson, and gold. Compared to the ugly brown and black devil scratcher fly, they seemed to belong to some other planet. Many trout flies were half the size of a penny. Salmon flies were huge, tied on jet black hooks up to 4 inches long. Edwin could tie a trout fly in under a minute. A single salmon fly demanded 10 hours or more behind the vise. The man who'd created them was standing nearby, watching as the boys examined each fly with reverence. He tried not to eavesdrop on their hushed conversation, but he grinned when he heard them murmur about the structural complexity of the flies. These weren't normal kids. They were tires. And so it was that the brothers met Edward Muzzy Muzzerell. Muzzy, a marine designer who worked on Aegis-class destroyers at the Bath Ironworks shipyard in Maine, spent most of his spare time hooking trout and salmon in the Kennebec River. When it was too cold to fish, he tied flies and was considered a master of the Victorian salmon fly. His work had even graced the glossy cover of Fly Tire. The accompanying article was entitled, Tying with Exotic Materials, Avoiding the Long Arm of the Law. The judges announced that the boys had won first place in their respective categories, but Edwin was so entranced by Muzzy's creations that the world of drab trout flies was rapidly losing its hold on his attention. Edwin pleaded with his dad to arrange lessons with Muzzy. By a happy coincidence, Muzzy's hometown of Sydney, Maine, happened to be the site of the New England Music Camp for gifted young musicians. The boys were accepted, and Edwin began counting down the days until he could learn to tie his first salmon fly. On the day Curtis and his boys headed over to Muzzy's for their first lesson in salmon flies, Edwin wore a bright red novelty t-shirt depicting a note from the desk of Toto, the terrier from The Wizard of Oz. Dear Dorothy, hate Oz, took the shoes, find your own way home. He was only 13, with oval-framed glasses and a spiked crop of hair. But as Muzzy escorted him through the fly shop toward the small table set up for tying Victorian salmon flies, he had the brooding quiet of a reverent pilgrim. Next to the vise, George Kelson's The Salmon Fly was open to a recipe. The Durham Ranger. Tag. Silver twist and yellow floss. Tail. One topping with Indian crow over. Butt. Two turns of black ostrich hurl. Body. Two turns of orange floss. Two turns of orange seal's fur, followed by black seal's fur. Ribs. Silver lace and silver tinsel. Hackle. Over the wool, only a red cocky bondi hackle. Throat. Light blue hackle. Wings. A pair of long jungle cock feathers with double tippets on both sides, outer tippets reaching to the first dark band of the inner tippets with a topping over all. Cheeks. Chatterer. Horns. Blue macaw. Head. Black Berlin wool. The Durham Ranger, introduced in the 1840s by a Mr. William Henderson of Durham, England, demanded the crest feathers of the golden pheasant from the mountain forests of China, black and fiery orange breast feathers from the red-ruffed fruit crow, known to fly tiers as Indian crow, of South America, ribbon-like filaments of ostrich hurl feathers from South Africa, and tiny turquoise plumes from the blue chatterer of the lowlands of Central America. The fly was like a snapshot of the British Empire at mid-century. Employing plumes shipped up by ostrich farmers in the Cape Colony, blue chatterer and Indian crow extracted from British Guiana, and golden pheasant crated in the port of Hong Kong. But Edwin would not tie with rare feathers that morning. Muzzy laid out a series of substitute feathers, or subs, from game and breeder birds. Instead of hard-to-get Indian crow or blue chatterer, there was ring-necked pheasant, dyed turkey, and feathers from the more common kingfisher. Over the next 8 hours, Muzzy introduced the brothers to the arcane tricks of tying Victorian flies, regaling them with stories about the godfathers of the art form like Blacker, Traherne, and Kelson, who tried to one-up each other with increasingly extravagant flies. He spoke of the magic of tying with real feathers instead of substitutes like turkey feathers, which have a round quill that is vexingly difficult to lash to a hook without it slipping. As Edwin tried flattening them with needle-nose pliers, Muzzy rhapsodized about how much easier it was to tie with Indian crow. At one step in the process, Edwin slipped on a pair of white silk gloves to prevent the oils in his hands from tarnishing the fly. The lost era of the art form seemed so close. He was communing with it, using the same types of tools, following the rules of century-old books. The only thing that had changed was the law, which placed the feathers in Kelson's book frustratingly out of reach. As the boys tied, Muzzy tried to make small talk, but he could see how engrossed they were by their partially completed Durham Rangers. They would check in on each other's work, offering compliments and critiques before firing off another technical question at Muzzy. When he asked what they did for fun back home, he wasn't surprised by their response. They tied flies. On the second day, they tied the Baron, a fly praised by Kelson for use in the rivers of Norway. The original recipe required feathers from 12 different species of birds across the globe, plucked from ostriches and peacocks, Indian crows and blue chatterers, swans and summer ducks, jays and macaws, golden pheasants and jungle cocks. In How to Dress Salmon Flies, one of the Victorian compendiums of fly tying published in 1914, T.E. Price Tannett encouraged aspiring tiers to get duck and partridge skins from friends who hunted local game birds. But when it came to finding Brazilian blue chatterer skins, the Brit had no practical advice. "I only wish I possessed such a friend." Of course, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918 had made it illegal to buy feathers of birds as common as the blue jay. Even if one dropped lifeless from the sky and landed at Edwin's feet, he could be fined for picking it up. After 16 hours of instruction, Edwin had tied his first two flies. Before they piled into the car for the drive home, Muzzy approached Edwin with a small envelope. "This is what it's all about," he murmured to the boy, who opened it to find $250 worth of Indian crow and blue chatterer feathers in tiny Ziploc bags, enough for about two flies. The feathers were legal, but rare and prohibitively expensive to a 13-year-old. "Don't tie with them yet, not till you're ready," he told the wide-eyed boy. "You gotta work up to these things." Back in Claverick, Edwin and his brother commandeered the garage and converted it into a laboratory for Victorian salmon flies, where they built upon the foundation Muzzy had laid. They called themselves the Fly Boys. Working with substitutes, they boiled, steamed, oiled, glued, bent, twisted, crimped, stripped, trimmed, and massaged the fibers into shape. When they hit a wall, they'd call their teacher or experiment by trial and error until they figured it out. When Edwin ran out of wax, he went into the yard with a power drill and bored a hole into a pine tree, collecting the sap that bled out. He learned how to use a cauterizer to burn away any unwanted feather fluff. When the cauterizer broke, he turned a blowtorch on his awl-like bodkin until it was red hot and ready to burn off extraneous fibers. The learning curve was steep. Sometimes, after hours hunched over the vise, Edwin's fingers would slip up and the fly would unravel. There were disasters, like when their dad flipped on the overhead fan in the garage and inadvertently stirred up a tornado of formerly organized feathers. Edwin relentlessly pursued his hobby, trying to replicate what he saw in Fly Tire and in Kelson's and Blacker's books. Once he was skilled enough, he emulated the masters by inventing his own flies, with names like the Weirdo Fly and Edwin's Fancy. "They would spend all day out there if we let them," Edwin's mom told a local journalist who had come to profile the Fly Boys. "But occasionally my husband and I force them to come in and eat." That fall, Edwin was accepted as an early admit to nearby Columbia Green Community College. The 13-year-old planned to study fine arts. But Edwin's artistic pursuits behind the fly-tying vice were hampered by the fact that he didn't have the real feathers. Through brute repetition, he had developed the technical skills needed to tie Victorian flies, but he was constantly frustrated. To an untrained eye, his creations looked exactly like Kelson's, but to him, they were adulterated, compromised by the use of substitutes like turkey and pheasant. It was only when he finally got online that he realized he wasn't alone in his obsession. After a member of ClassicFlyTying.com, the largest online forum for Victorian fly tires, wrote in a post, There is something to a fly tied with the old materials. Bud Guidry, the site's administrator, responded swiftly. I've met this something. I'm haunted by it constantly now, wrote Guidry, a shrimp-boating Cajun from the tiny bayou town of Galliano, south of New Orleans. It's like a drug. Nothing else matters. Nothing else compares. When it touches my fingers, I feel the history. I'm taken back to a time when fish were as big as logs, fresh from the sea. Reds, yellows, and shades of blues. Their texture and color have that power to push you to do your best. There is nothing else that compares to that power. But the opportunity to experience that something was available only to the wealthiest tyers, those who could afford feathers from the birds cited in the original recipes, now even more expensive and elusive than they were in Kelson's day. Aware that their flies were a kind of status symbol, they presented them in decadently staged photographs. One hooked a jockscot with 15 different species of birds, toucan, bustard, macaw, Indian crow, and more, into the cork of a bottle of 20-year single malt, a cut crystal scotch glass nearby. The backgrounds of such pictures were often littered with piles of priceless feathers, whole skins of rare birds, or patches of polar bear and monkey fur, an homage to Victorian excess. Edwin was desperate to gain access to this level of tying. On Muzzy's recommendation, he reached out to one of the kingpins of the exotic feather trade, a grizzled, chain-smoking, retired detective from Detroit named John McLean, who ran a website called FeathersMC.com. If you're going to tie good flies, you have to have good materials, proclaimed McLean's site, which offered nearly every kind of feather. For Edwin, a 14-year-old student, the prices were astronomical. The Argus pheasant, a near-threatened bird that roams the lowland hill forests of the Malay Peninsula, is prized by fly tyers for its 30-inch quills that are marked with olive-colored eye spots known as ocelli. Linnaeus named the species after Argus panoptes, the hundred-eyed giant from Greek mythology that never slept. McLean sold its feathers for $6.95 an inch, making a single quill worth more than $200. 10 blue chatterer feathers went for $59.99. 10 Indian crow feathers, each no larger than a fingernail, sold for $99.95, with a limit of one packet per customer, to ensure everybody that wants some of the real thing will be able to get them. With dreams of Argus, Edwin went to work, wading into the waist-high ferns behind his home to gather firewood for his neighbors, who paid him a few bucks an hour to run pine through their wood splitter. When McLean got a call from a teenager wanting to buy a few $100 worth of Argus and other feathers, the former detective was suspicious.
Do your parents know you're calling me? He asked.
Edwin put his mom on the line. When the feathers finally arrived, Edwin handled them gingerly. He had worked so hard for them that he was reluctant to cut into them. It was like learning how to sculpt on a priceless slab of marble. As McLean got to know Edwin, he quickly realized that the boy's appetite for feathers far outstripped what he could afford. So he began to impart some of his strategies for finding feathers. Edwin found a retired ornithology professor willing to sell full bird skins on the cheap. He called up the Bronx Zoo, which sent him feathers from the autumn molt of macaw, spoonbill, tragopan, and other species in their collection. He wrangled some Cory bustard and toucan feathers from species preservation societies. He began to scour eBay for exotic birds. In the early days of the auction site, sellers occasionally posted antique bird cases with little knowledge of the rarity of each species, but was usually outbid by grown men with deeper pockets. Sometimes, when a rarity like the blue chatterer was listed, tyers would join forces to outbid others, splitting the spoils among themselves. Others bid on antique salmon flies solely to razor them apart for their feathers. Everyone searched for Victorian hats, but they rarely appeared on the auction site. When a well-known fly tyer died, community members would publicly express their condolences and privately move on the feathers he left behind. Supply never kept up with demand. McLean sold a lot of valuable feathers, but when it came to the most sought-after, blue chatterer, Indian crow, resplendent quetzal, and birds of paradise, there was a veritable drought. Most of the posts on classicflytying.com were made by tires obsessively searching for plumes. Some threads read like confessionals, where the authors admitted the birds they coveted most in wistful tones. Indian crow, blue chatterer, and resplendent quetzal topped the list. It was a seller's market. Anyone who found a new source of the rare birds stood to make a lot of money fast. As Edwin's prominence in the community grew, Master Tyers would occasionally send him a few feathers to help him complete a particular fly. One of them was Luc Couturier, a French-Canadian renowned for his extravagant flies. In 2001, he earned the distinction of tying all 28 Traherne flies, named after a 19th-century British soldier whose flies were seen by many as the pinnacle of the art form. Kelson himself had declared him the master of infinite elaboration. There are no salmon flies in creation requiring so much patient work to dress well as Major Traherne's. A single fly, known as the Chatterer, called for an astonishing 150 to 200 blue chatterer feathers, which, if anyone could locate such a quantity, would cost nearly $2,000. Couturier was an evangelist for taking salmon flies to new aesthetic heights, breaking free of a slavish adherence to 19th century recipes. He pioneered what he called thematical flies, inspired by a close study of a particular species of bird, chiefly the Indian crow, blue chatterer, and birds of paradise. When Edwin first saw Couturier's Orenosensis fly, named after the Orenosensis subspecies of the Indian crow, he thought it was a painting. The fly, which Edwin once described as a satanic moth, was loaded with priceless feathers, including those from the condor's tail. After Edwin came across Couturier's Paradisea minor fly, celebrating the lesser bird of paradise, he nervously reached out to the Quebecois master, asking him for guidance. When Couturier replied, Edwin felt as though he had a message from Michelangelo or Da Vinci in his inbox. They struck up a correspondence, trading several emails a day as Edwin absorbed his secrets. Couturier sent him rare feathers and special hooks, and even designed a fly dedicated to Edwin and his brother. In a 2007 article written for the website of Ron Lucas, a legendary hook maker, Edwin wrote, "Fly tying is not merely a hobby. It is an obsession we seem to devote a substantial part of our time to, examining feather structure, designing flies, and coming up with new techniques for getting exactly what we want out of a fly." He scrimped and saved to pull together enough materials for one such creation, nicknamed the Blacker Celebration Fly, in honor of the art form's patriarch, William Blacker. The fly included feathers from the Indian crow, golden-headed quetzal, flame bowerbird, superb bird of paradise, and Katinga. When he posted a picture of it on the forum, the community was gobsmacked. "Good grief, Edwin," replied one tire. "The only materials on that fly that aren't on the CITES list are the flosses, the tinsels, and the GP crests," referring to the golden pheasant. "Do you and Anton live in an aviary, perchance? That at least would explain how you get your young hands on so many rare and exotic feathers." Even as his hobby became an obsession, Edwin had other things in his life. He was traveling to New York City each week for flute lessons and performances, having earned a spot in the New York Youth Symphony's orchestra, chamber music, and composition programs, as well as in the Interschool Orchestra of New York. At 16, Edwin became a regular at the American Museum of Natural History when David Dickey, his former biology tutor, secured him an internship in the herpetology department. He was given a key card to the back offices and was taught about the procedures for handling the museum's collection of reptile and amphibian skeletons, which were stored in a locked room monitored by security cameras. Around that time, his parents were debating how to make use of their spare land in Claverick. Lynn had wanted to grow an herb garden, while Curtis thought it'd be fun to raise American bison, which had come back from the brink of extinction thanks to Congress's 1884 decision to authorize the army to protect the final few hundred from poachers. They settled on breeding hypoallergenic Australian labradoodles, a cross between a Labrador and a poodle, that would fetch up to several thousand dollars a puppy. Edwin pitched in as webmaster for the newly named Hudson Doodles business. But whenever there was free time, he was back in the garage tying flies. He was now teaching others in the community, sharing 20-page step-by-step instructions with close-up photos and running commentary on classicflytying.com. He wrote with the chatty confidence of a host on a cooking show, noting that the fly looks a little droopy in one picture, but that when preening a fly, it is ridiculously easy to over-rub or break a crest feather. He took questions from grateful tires, happily sharing his tricks. Within a few years of first laying eyes on Muzzy's salmon flies, Edwin and his brother had joined the small fraternity of masters. In early 2005, Dave Klausmeier, editor of Fly Tire, formalized their ascension by proclaiming, "They are two of the finest young gentlemen you'd hope to meet, and they prove that the future of fly tying is in good hands." But Edwin never saw mastery as having an end. As an artist, believing he had perfected any technique was anathema to him. Fly tying was an endless search for perfection. Some days he tied better than others. Some days he made mistakes he thought he'd long since moved past. He approached the art form with a humble, monkish devotion. As Muzzy put it in a profile on Edwin and Anton that ran on McLean's website, "All they need to remember is they are entering a school you never graduate from." Like Couturier, he was trying to achieve something transcendental. Fly tying had become a search for something more profound than tying turkey feathers to a hook. "I'm toying with the idea of tying a series with each species of Katinga and Crow," he told John McLean, referring to the 5 different subspecies of Indian Crow and 7 species of Katinga, the blue chatterer, one of which was on the endangered species list. "But that may not be practical right now." And while the demands of the flute took priority, visions of all the Victorian patterns he had yet to tie floated through his mind like apparitions, always beckoning. He regarded the "future of fly tying" moniker as an obligation to strive even harder. But the higher he climbed, the more difficult it was to distinguish himself. Couturier had tied all 28 Traherne flies. It took years for Marvin Nolte, another master, to tie 342 flies for a private collector in Wyoming. There were dozens of recipes in Blacker's Art of Angling, and close to 300 in Kelson's The Salmon Fly. At his current rate, Edwin would be chasing feathers for 100 years before he had enough to tie them all. In 2006, at 16, Edwin earned an associate's degree in fine arts from Columbia Green Community College with a spot on the president's list. Having decided to become a professional musician, he applied to the Juilliard School in New York City and the Royal Academy of Music in London, two of the most competitive music institutions in the world, which admitted only a handful of flautists each year. He dreamed of becoming the principal flute chair in the Berlin Philharmonic. It was perhaps the most coveted spot there was, but he knew it was pointless to pursue anything but the best. Following his older brother's lead, Anton enrolled at Columbia Green as a 13-year-old, with aspirations of performing as a concert clarinetist. In the spring of 2007, Edwin was accepted by the Royal Academy of Music in London. He would live on the southern edge of Regent's Park, home to the London Zoo, which had housed the first live birds of paradise that Wallace had brought back from the Malay archipelago. Suddenly, the Berlin Philharmonic didn't seem like such an outlandish goal. That summer, as he packed his things, he decided to leave behind his fly-tying materials and feather collection. He was worried customs officers in the UK might seize them, but more important, he was going to London to study the flute, not to tie flies. He needed to stay focused. On the eve of his departure, he got an email from Luke Couturier, telling him about a magical place in England he had to visit. Attached were photos of the bird-filled drawers of the Natural History Museum in Tring. Part 2. The Tring Heist. Chapter 7. Featherless in London. In the fall of 2007, Edwin Rist began his studies at the Royal Academy of Music. It had taken over a decade of devotion to the flute, a relentless schedule of private lessons, rehearsals, and practice to earn a coveted spot at the school, whose alumni are launched into the finest orchestras or, like Elton John, pop superstardom. Edwin's schedule was demanding. In between classes and practice, there was an endless offering of guest lectures and performances by distinguished musicians. He didn't struggle with the transition from the solitude of homeschooling to college life in a big city. He was no stranger to the world of overachieving musicians, and he had little difficulty making friends, knowing instinctively how important it was to get along with everyone since they all performed together. But it only took 4 weeks after arriving in London for his other passion, the one he'd intended to set aside during his studies, to reassert its hold on him. On October 10th, 2007, he logged on to classicflytying.com to see if anyone would be willing to split the cost of a hotel room at the upcoming British Fly Fair International, BFFI, a couple of hundred miles north of London at the upmarket estate of Trentham Gardens. Like the shows that he'd frequented in the United States, the BFFI would host dozens of fly-tying demonstrations, alongside some 80 vendor booths brimming with feathers, silks, vices, and hooks. "Unfortunately, I'm not tying at the show. Customs wouldn't like my birdie bag," Edwin wrote, referring to the feathers he'd painstakingly collected over the years. "But I'd still like to see some old faces." A forum member reminded him that the fair was only an hour away from the fishing cabin of Isaac Walton, author of The Complete Angler, built in 1671 on the banks of the River Dove. He'd been tying flies for nearly as long as he'd been playing the flute. And here he was, in the land that spawned his beloved art form, without any feathers or materials. As if to add insult to injury, when he set out for Trentham Gardens, an 8-hour train delay kept him from attending the BFFI. 2 months into term, he visited the Natural History Museum in South Kensington, snapping photos of specimens and curios on display, cases full of stuffed birds of paradise, sapphires and diamonds. In the mammals' hall, next to a massive whale skeleton, was an American mastodon, not incognitum from his hometown, but Missourium, exhumed in the 1840s from a spring in Missouri. Back at his dorm, he posted pictures of his visit to Facebook, including images of the flame bower bird and the velvety black bird of paradise known as Laws's Parotia. But the magnificent collection he'd heard about from Luke Couturier, the vast repository with hundreds of thousands of birds, was somewhere out of sight, walled off from the public. In January 2008, Edwin received an invitation to demonstrate his mastery at the Bristol Fly Dressers Guild. He leaped at the opportunity. His host, a prominent British tyer named Terry, asked what fly he hoped to tie. Edwin shared some recipes from Kelson's The Salmon Fly, but stressed that he was completely without materials. A month before the presentation, Terry took down the required materials for the Stevenson fly like a grocery list. Edwin had very specific requests. Twisted silkworm gut, ultra-fine white thread, a 6-aught size hook, Lagerton silk. When Terry, who had agreed to put him up in his Bristol flat for several days, asked what kind of food he liked, Edwin replied, "I will eat absolutely anything, as long as it's not disgusting a la McDonald's, and in large quantities. I am, after all, still a student, and a fairly starved one at that. I'm trying to sort out how I can bring over materials from home for next semester," Edwin added. "Life without tying is fairly harsh, but having a fortune in feathers confiscated by customs would be worse. To tie in England, he'd need to rebuild a collection of materials from scratch. He had poked around London's antique shops in a vain search for Victorian-era hats and bird-filled natural history cabinets, and on the few occasions when he found a birdskin auction of a recently deceased aristocrat, the items were far beyond the reach of his student budget. The screen name he used to upload videos from his time at the Academy to YouTube, Edwin Resplendent, might have reflected his longing. The emerald resplendent Quetzal feathers were prized by anyone hoping to tie rarities like the ghost fly or Wheatley's Fly No. 8 of 1849, which also calls for King Bird of Paradise plumes. But King Bird of Paradise feathers rarely appeared on the marketplace. The resplendent Quetzal was endangered, listed in Appendix 1 of CITES, making it all but impossible to possess. His early efforts to source feathers thwarted, he found his thoughts returning again and again to the email Luc Couturier had sent him, and he decided he needed to see the greatest collection in the world. According to the Natural History Museum's website, its ornithological collection included 700,000 skins, 15,000 skeletons, 17,000 specimens in spirit, full birds pickled in large jars, 4,000 nests, and 400,000 sets of eggs. Over 2 kilometers of shelves were needed to hold the birds in spirit alone. The specimens safeguarded there represented about 95% of the world's known species. Many of them had been gathered before the British Museum was founded in 1753. Edwin clicked through to the Access to the Collections page and saw that researchers and artists could visit by prior appointment. He doubted the museum would grant him access if he said he was a fly-tyer keen on seeing exotic birds. He considered his options. He had always wanted to write a book in the tradition of Kelson, to share his expertise with the next generation of tyers. Perhaps he could request access in order to take photographs of beautiful specimens to include in it. But the museum was unlikely to admit someone without a background in writing, much less someone without a publisher. Finally, he struck upon a solution. He would write in the name of research. On February 9th, 2008, 4 days before he was scheduled to tie at the Bristol Fly Dressers Guild, Edwin emailed the museum under his own name, saying that a friend at Oxford, who was working on a dissertation on birds of paradise, had asked him to take high-resolution photographs on his behalf. As part of its security protocol, the museum asked Edwin for the email address of the Oxford student in order to verify his request. Edwin created a fake email account under his friend's name. When the museum sent the verification email, they were in fact writing to Edwin. Access was granted, and a date was set in March for him to come photograph Alfred Russel Wallace's Birds of Paradise. The day before the demonstration in Bristol, Edwin and Terry stopped at Veal's Fishing Tackle, a short walk from the Broadmead shopping mall in the center of town. Edwin bought a pair of J-wings, which were easy to purchase in the UK but prohibited in the United States. Across town, little egrets, once sold by the millions for the millinery trade, flapped through the open-air section of the Bristol Zoo known as the Alfred Russel Wallace Aviary. That night, they did a practice fly-tying session at Terry's home so that Edwin wouldn't feel rusty. But there was no need for concern. The following evening, he dazzled several dozen of Terry's friends in the Fly Dressers Guild, tying the Stevenson. The fly's body was a bright shock of orange-dyed seal fur, with silver tinsel threaded throughout. Wings of black-tipped orange-golden pheasant feathers enveloped a pair of blackened orange cream-colored jungle cock feathers. The pattern was remarkably similar to the first salmon fly he'd ever tied, with Muzzy, the Durham Ranger. Like Muzzy, Terry supplied Edwin with substitute feathers from ordinary birds for his demonstration. Terry had seen Edwin's flies on the forum, but when he witnessed the 18-year-old's talents in action, he was overcome. "He is the best salmon tyer I have ever seen. He is probably in the top 5 in the world," Terry raved in a note to the national president of the Fly Dressers Guild, urging him to book Edwin at as many of its chapters, which number several dozen throughout England, as possible. "Everyone who attended was amazed. When Edwin got back to his dorm room at the Royal Academy, he dashed off a thank you note to Terry. I look forward to coming back, he added. Hopefully by then I'll have my own equipment and materials here, and we'll be able to put on a real show. On the day of his appointment to photograph the birds of paradise, Edwin returned to the South Kensington campus of the Natural History Museum in London. The curators in charge of the bird skin collection had told him to cut through the parking lot and ring the buzzer on a door to the ornithology building, located behind the public museum. He could scarcely contain his excitement as he wandered around the lot, high-end digital SLR camera in hand, searching for the entrance. A security guard noticed him and offered his help. When Edwin mentioned his appointment to visit the ornithological collection, the guard smiled and told him he was at the wrong branch of the museum, in the wrong city. The skins hadn't been in London for decades. Embarrassed, Edwin returned to his dorm room and began researching how to get to the tiny town of Tring. The public portion of the Tring Museum is a striking example of Victorian architecture, with steep pitched roofs, red brick walls, high peaked gables, chimneys, and dormers. Kids play in the adjacent park, while parents refuel at the Zebra Cafe next to the museum entrance. By stark contrast, the building housing the largest ornithological collection in the world is a four-story brutalist fortress of concrete, looming in a corner of the museum complex. On November 5th, 2008, Edwin strode through the main entrance of the ornithology building. A security guard standing behind a counter welcomed him and asked for his ID. He signed his name in the visitor's logbook while the guard phoned the staff's office to announce his arrival. A staffer escorted him into the bird vault, where the museum's hundreds of thousands of bird skins are carefully stored in 1,500 white steel cabinets, occupying tens of thousands of square feet spread over several floors. The air was thick with the smell of mothballs, used to protect specimens against insect damage. To shield the birds from damage from ultraviolet rays, there were narrow windows that only let in a faint amount of sunlight. The staffer deposited the visitor in front of the cabinets marked Paradiseidae, the birds of paradise. Before wandering off, he mentioned the locations of a number of other species he thought the photographer might like to see, gestured to a colleague in the corner of the room, and instructed Edwin to let him know when you're done. Edwin opened the cabinet doors. Inside were rows of drawers, some 24 in each cabinet. He slowly pulled one out to reveal a dozen adult male magnificent rifle birds lying on their backs. He removed his trembling hand from the drawer pull. He'd never seen a full skin before, much less a dozen of them. The birds, about a foot in length, had a robe of deep black feathers, accented by a breastplate of metallic bluish-green feathers that turned purple in the right light. Their eyes had been stuffed with cotton, and biodata labels hung from their legs, recording the altitude, latitude, longitude, date of capture, and name of the collector. Several bore the faded handwriting of Alfred Russel Wallace. The drawer below held another dozen, and the drawer below that, a dozen more, all in perfect condition. Rifle bird feathers were rarely listed for sale on classicflytying.com, and when they were, their scarcity made them more valuable. In 2008, 10 rifle bird breast feathers had sold for $50 on the forum. With more than 500 feathers per breast, a single skin might fetch $2,500. Tens of thousands of dollars were resting in the drawers of the first cabinet he opened alone, like lightweight iridescent bricks of gold. And rows of cabinets stretched down the hallways for what seemed like miles. Standing inside the Tring Museum was like being in the vault of Fort Knox, the repository of centuries of mining where the United States gold bullion is stored. At some point, the value becomes incomprehensible. Once he pulled himself together, Edwin carefully removed one of the birds from the drawer, brought it over to a research table, and took a picture. After he returned it, he surreptitiously snapped a photograph of the cabinet. He moved to the cabinet that held the king bird of paradise. As Wallace described the specimens he'd gathered in the forests of Aru, 10 of which were now within Edwin's reach, The head, throat, and entire upper surface are of the richest glossy crimson red, shading to orange crimson on the forehead, shining in certain lights with a metallic or glassy luster. Edwin took a photograph of his favorite specimen, snapped another of the quarter of cabinets that housed hundreds of skins from all 39 species of the birds of paradise, then moved on to the museum's collection of Central and South American Katingidae family of birds, which included